This is Solidarity Journal. Share in a common voice. Just might find your own.
To think that this was John Doe.
It's like the argument about the argument in part. No, we fought an entire goddamn war. States' right to do what?
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able
Thanks
to
for tuning in to the Solidarity Journal on WAZU 90.7 FM, Peoria's one and only Pacifica radio affiliate. I'm your host, Michael Perillo. On today's show, I'll give my 9/11 expose and my thoughts of the 10th anniversary that just passed this last weekend. Also, we'll have Nancy Long give a report and some audio from the recent Radium Girls dedication in Ottawa, Illinois. And we'll hear featured music, Larry Harms Trio, which performed live at the Art Show. So stay tuned to Solidarity Journal and prepare to get it. Solidarity Journal on WAZU 90.7 FM, Peoria's one and only Pacifica radio affiliate. I'm your host, Michael Perillo. This past weekend was the 10th anniversary of September 11, 2001, attacks that brought down the World Trade Center. Throughout the morning and evening, I watched and read most of the local coverage and articles about it, and the national as well. And overall, it highlighted what we already know, that the day was fairly traumatic for people and changed how we viewed the world. But there was a lot, like every other year, that gets left out, possibly even forgotten by many, or more than likely, things that just are completely unknown to the public. Jane Mayer, in her book, The Dark Side, opens up with an introduction describing how in the 1980s, former Vice President Dick Cheney had been secretly preparing himself for a doomsday scenario. He would at random leave in the middle of the night, go to an undisclosed area, and perform this doomsday drill. He would pretend for weeks that he was the chief of staff and a substitute to being president if the rest of the cabinet was wiped out. This drill was to keep continuity within the political structure and a functioning government if there happened to be an attack of all-out nuclear war, presumably at that time the Soviet Union. This cautionary ritual was a prelude to September 11, 2001. The fear of being attacked had overcome Cheney, and after September 11, 2001, the rest of the country and the White House administration would also follow suit. We have become paranoid and fearful. We'd cling to the lies that were fed to us, why they hate us, what we would have to do to stop them, and there are many others that are still repeated to this day. We've accepted the dehumanization of others. We let the government erode the very civil liberties that some of us mindlessly chant we're protecting while we give them up for so-called security purposes. We accept the illegal wars of aggression that have killed the people in Iraq and in Afghanistan and Pakistan, Somalia and Yemen. We accepted revenge and the lies that led us there, lies that has taken this country to its death knell. When you read your local newspaper or watch the corporate news media, you will not hear much on why this happened, except it was a group of evil men who hijacked planes and crashed them into the Twin Towers, the Pentagon, and into Shanksville, Pennsylvania. You don't hear much about American terrorism and U.S.-supported terrorism, and how it contributed to the blowback we witnessed on September 11, 2001. You don't hear about how the CIA outfitted the Mujahideen in 1979 under President Carter, and by the 1980s, Reagan and his administration went full force by intentionally provoking the Soviet Union to invade Afghanistan, which gave us our chance to give the Soviets their own Vietnam. Once we trained, armed, and well-funded Osama bin Laden and the jihadists coming into Afghanistan through the CIA and Pakistan's inter-services intelligence, and also to fight the Soviets and bring terror upon its people, and once the USSR collapsed a few years after it withdrew from Afghanistan, defeated, we left the people there, of that country, to their own devices and to fight their own civil war. From this, birthed the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and resentment. And when we stationed U.S. bases in the Persian Gulf, bin Laden was furious. And when we fired missiles at a Sudan pharmaceutical factory, destroying it because the Clinton administration thought it was being used for making chemical weapons, which later, the evidence given for that was practically non-existent, tens of thousands of people, many of them children, had suffered and died from malaria, tuberculosis, and other treatable diseases. We infuriated bin Laden and many others. We brought a sanction onto Iraq in the 90s, which dismantled the country, killing an estimated 500,000 Iraqi children from water diseases, all the while supporting the apartheid in Israel, where the Palestinians are treated subhuman and have no sovereignty. Nor will you hear about how the Taliban, after the USS Cole bombing in January of 2001, would have surrendered bin Laden if the U.S. produced any shred of evidence against him and be assured he would receive a fair trial in a third country. This idea was shot down. In October 7, 2001, the Taliban would again say that they'd extradite bin Laden to an Islamic country for trial. Bush rejected this offer and gave an ultimatum: immediate extradition of bin Laden and other Al-Qaeda leaders, and closing of all terrorist training camps filed a direct U.S. inspection. Also, the Taliban leader, Mullah Omar, received a private message from the U.S. government that read, "Every pillar of the Taliban regime will be destroyed." The Taliban had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda, and it had known nothing, according to bin Laden, of the September 11, 2001 attacks. It was also divulged recently in memos from officials showing the American strategy of destroying Al-Qaeda and the Taliban without substantially investing in Afghan infrastructure and economic well-being. In 2006, U.S. Ambassador to Afghanistan Ronald R. Newman asserted that recommendations to, quote, "minimize economic assistance and leave out infrastructure plays into the Taliban strategy, not ours." Nor do you hear about the intelligence failures by the CIA, FBI, and Joint Forces Intelligence Command, JFIC. You won't hear JFIC's anti-terrorism work on Al-Qaeda, bin Laden, and the Taliban, and the warnings that the World Trade Center and the Pentagon would be attacked. You won't hear how this came to a halt by orders from senior government officials. You won't read about how former counterterrorism czar Richard Clark has made allegations against three former top CIA officials, George Tenet, Coffer Black, and Richard Blee, accusing them of knowingly withholding intelligence from the Bush and Clinton White House, the FBI, and the State and Defense Departments, about two of the September 11, 2001 hijackers who had entered the United States more than a year before they attacked. Nor will you hear a 2010 report from the majority staff of the Subcommittee on National Security and Foreign Affairs in the U.S. House of Representatives showing that we, taxpayers, are the main money line to the Taliban in Afghanistan. There are payoffs to the Taliban for this logistical transport of items. This has long been known by U.S. officials. You won't hear a lot of this in your national and local news. The images you will see played on repeat are the towers falling. You'll read the newspaper report of people's individual stories, where they describe the pain they felt on that day. The problem is that pain was then later used for revenge and has been strong for the past decade. For example, this revenge was on full display 3 days after the September 11, 2001 attacks. President Bush made his way to where the World Trade Center once stood, coming upon rescue workers whose faces and clothes covered from the soot-filled air. The mood turned from somber to revenge. One man looked Bush in the eye and said, "George, find the bastards who did this and kill them." Others would yell not to let them down and do whatever it takes. Once Bush was on top of the wreckage of what was once the World Trade Center, he gave the bloodlust speech.
"I can hear you! I can hear you! The rest of the world hears you! And the people... who knocked these buildings down will hear all of us soon.
This bloodlust cannot be quenched since the very men who committed this act of violence were now dead. We let the government tell us that we needed to lash out, to use lethal force and military action, to go and invade and destroy other countries, even though no country declared war on us or attacked us. September 11, 2001 brought us the illegal invasions and occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan. In Iraq, the lies that led us there are still believed by some to this day. Saddam Hussein had no connection to Al-Qaeda or bin Laden, nor did he have weapons of mass destruction. We have destroyed their country. We have ruined their lives. We have killed from 100,000 to 1 million Iraqis. We have displaced millions more. And Obama and the rest of this empire wants us to ignore the crimes they and others have committed and go unnoticed, but instead to focus on the crimes committed to us on September 11, 2001. September 11, 2001 has been commercialized. It asks of you and me and the rest of the world to not look past that day, but to use it as a rally cry. While those who were there and lost loved ones would mourn, the rest of the country would be washed over with a wave of nationalism. This became our infantile state. The dead that laid buried below the rubble became our martyrs, though part of our empathy and dignity survived that day. It did not take long for the government to twist the country's emotions and warp it to what we are now. We are fear. We are the surveillance state. We are the warmongers. We are the torturers in the salt pit, in Bagram, in Guantanamo, in Abu Ghraib. We are the drones and bombs that are killing families in far-distant villages. And, as Chris Hedges wrote recently regarding September 11th, 2001 and the years that followed, we are what we loathe. It could have been different, though. Instead of organizing the military to put permanent U.S. bases across the world and root our empire deeper into our mentality and other people's land, we could have taken the empathy that the world shared for us, and we could have worked with other countries to capture and try those who orchestrated the attacks. Instead, we became Dick Cheney doing the doomsday drill. Fear gripping us and keeping us locked in this path. Thanks for tuning in to the Solidarity Journal on WAZU 90.7 FM, Peoria's one and only Pacifica radio affiliate. I'm your host, Michael Perillo. Early this September, Nancy Long went to Ottawa, Illinois to honor the Radium Girls and to see the new monument that was built. For those of you who are unfamiliar with the Radium Girls, they were a group of courageous young women, their story that began 90 years ago. On William Pillow's website, it tells a story of the Radium Girls, which were mostly women in their teens and early 20s who worked in Ottawa radium dial plant starting around 1920. The dial painters were paid by the piece to apply paint neatly and evenly to the numbers on the clock faces. To ensure thin, even, accurate strokes, the dial painters were instructed to point the brush frequently by licking its end. The women didn't know that the radium used to make their paint glow was a very dangerous radioactive substance. They also had no idea that by lip pointing their brushes, they were ingesting enough of it to cause painful, crippling cancers and death. It goes on to say in 1925 that Radium Dial became aware of the occupational danger of radiation exposure and the poisoning that would follow in time. Radium Dial workers were examined by the company, and although many of the women already showed signs of radium poison, they were never told. Instead, the company kept the danger a secret, even telling the workers the material was good for them. So eventually this got out, and legal battles ensued, and the women obviously began to suffer from debilitating joint pain and bone fractures, and infections, bone tumors, and anemia. In the end, from the legal battles, the women only received very, very small financial settlements, and wasn't even enough to pay for their medical bills. So a lot of the local unions around Ottawa chipped in money to build a monument dedicated to the Radium Girls. So Nancy Long was at the dedication and listened to the speakers, as well as talked to some of the people in the crowd. First speaker was Bob Eschbach, the mayor of the Ottawa City.
Today I bring with me a message from Governor Pat Quinn. Whereas the occupational health and safety is a cross-disciplinary area concerned with protecting the safety, health, and welfare of people engaged in work and employment. And whereas workers' health, and especially low-income and women workers' health, was among central concerns of the social reform movement to improve public health in the early 20th century. And whereas some of these advocates, known as the Radium Girls, were young women who worked in the luminous dial painting industry in Ottawa, Illinois, painting clock faces with radium-based paint. And whereas, in order to produce consistent, even brush strokes on their painted clock faces, these young women were instructed to lick the brush, but never told about the dangers of radioactive materials. And whereas Radium Dial, a company later named Luminous Process, became aware of these dangers that were posed to their young employees in 1925, but hid the information until 1934, when seven women known as the Society of the Living Dead began a series of legal and social battles to spread awareness not only of the dangers of radioactive material, but also of the importance of occupational health and safety. Whereas the Radium Girls deserve the utmost respect and admiration from the residents of the state of Illinois and the United States of America concerning the issue of occupational health and safety, because they battled dishonest company, an indifferent industry, dismissive courts, and the medical community in the face of debilitating joint pain, bone fractures, infections, bone tumors, anemia, and certain death. And whereas believing that all working men and women in our state deserve the opportunity to make a living and raise families by working under the safest conditions possible, the state of Illinois has long been a national leader in promoting health and safety in the workplace. However, occupational health disparities still exist in our state and throughout the nation. And whereas on Friday, September 2nd, 2011, A bronze monument will be dedicated to the Radium Girls at the site of the old Luminous Process Building in Ottawa, Illinois, in honor of the dedication, persistence, bravery that they demonstrated in their fight to set safety standards for industrial exposure to radiation, making dial painting and other industries safer for all workers. Therefore, I, Pat Quinn, Governor of the State of Illinois, do hereby proclaim September 2nd, 2011 as Radium Girls Day in Illinois in recognition of the tremendous perseverance, dedication, and sense of justice the Radium Girls exhibited in their fight for workplace safety and the importance of occupational health and safety for all working men and women in the land of Lincoln.
Then Madame Piller, who first started the Radium Girls campaign when she was only an eighth grade student, took to the mic.
I'd like to thank the city of Ottawa for accepting this. It's been a long time coming. And the subject is no longer taboo. Something that stared in the face as ugly has become something so beautiful. I'm so proud for that and so thankful for that. Also, as much as Ottawa has changed in the last 5 years, so have I. I was so short when I started working with the mayor. I was like this tall. And you can see, as I have grown, the monument and the dream and the desire has grown also. Over 5 years of my life has been changed permanently, and by being involved with this project, it has really grown with me, made me the person I am. And with that, I'd like to encourage you all. I'm going to give a pitch for volunteering. Volunteer. Do what you can. Make something great, because this is something that will last forever. Something to these women, to these very important, meaningful women that they'd never had before, and now they have. All started with one person, and now all of us here are involved. Thank you so much.
Then Larry Spivak, director of AFSCME Council 31, spoke.
It's important for us who remember labor history in Illinois and around the country. I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. I, like you, come here today to remember the Radium Girls, but like Joe Hill, they are not dead. They don't only remain in our hearts and minds, but they are alive with every worker and everywhere who struggles on any given day to work with dignity and respect. So in the end, we are not remembering for the sake of remembering, we are remembering so that we may act. Think about it, my friends. What we're saying is that for the short-term profit of a few, we will jeopardize the life of thousands and sometimes millions. But we can stop this. But this story is told over and over again because, as Will Rogers said, the short memories of voters is what keeps the politicians in office. But despite a tendency to forget, we do create monuments and statues that help us recall the reasons that we choose to act, to remind us to demonstrate, to act collectively, to lobby in Springfield, to march around the town square, to picket in front of the workplace that needs picketing. Because what is right is the human right for all workers to a safe job, to be compensated as fully as possible for the value of one's labor. This, my friends, is what we call dignity and respect. My friends, the struggle for dignity and respect on the job is the same struggle that Joe Hill sang about in his ode to Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, the rebel girl. This is the struggle that caused Mother Jones to seek to be buried with her minor angels who died in Verdun. This is the struggle about the right for mine safety after the Cherry Mine disaster just a few miles down the road where 259 men and boys died in 1909. And this is the same struggle that the Haymarket Martyrs engaged in when they fought and they died for the 8-hour day and the right to organize. This, my friends, is why we create monuments. We need to remember so that we can act. This is why there is an Illinois Labor History Society. Otherwise, we are doomed to repeat only the mistakes. So we have to overcome our amnesia. We sometimes forget to take action when our wages are stripped from us, our livelihoods are stolen by outsourcing them to child labor in China and Indonesia. We too often operate on the fear that yet something worse can happen. But you know what? It can't get much worse. You can die a quick hanging or a slow poisoning, but you're going to die a more painful death if you do nothing. It may not be a physical death, but it may and will be a spirit-breaking death through unemployment, unsafe jobs, a tyrannical boss that beats you down every day, and the loss of the incredible dignity and purpose that you deserve on the job. Whether you're a prison guard, a direct care worker, a police officer, a firefighter, a crane operator, you fix the potholes, you work in the hospital, you take care of people in a hospital, you are a CPA down the street, you deserve the right to fair wage and a safe workplace and a voice to determine how those things should be handled. This is why I remember the Radium Girls. This is why I am so happy to be here today. It reminds me of our common purpose and social responsibility. Just having this will allow me to wake up on Tuesday and go back out and fight like hell for the living while I pray for the dead, as Mother Jones told us to do. I won't mourn for the Radium Girls. I will organize in the name of the Radium Girls, just like Joe Hill would have said, and I hope you will do the same.
Then Tim Runyon, affiliated with the Nuclear Safety, who inspected and found wide range of radiation in Ottawa, talked to the people about the dangers and what it was that he found.
And then eventually US EPA. But, and some of y'all may remember the 1986 flyover where we brought in the helicopter and flew over town. It caused quite a stir for a while. However, in that process, we identified about 15 offsite areas where radium contamination existed. And we actually found everything ranging from a little bit of radium contamination in soil to an actual bottle of paint that somebody had buried in their wall, in the wall of their house, obviously believing that the value was such that they could hang on to it, maybe for a later benefit. In any case, once we identified those sites were graded by US EPA contractors for inclusion on what's called the National Priorities List. And fortunately, I was one of the personal guides for the contractors that were grading the sites for the NPL, and I made sure I took them to all the right places. And the sites did actually make the NPL list. All the sites made the NPL list collectively. Out of the 15 different sites that we identified, we've cleaned up and remediated all but two of the sites. And the sites that have been remediated were all the sites that were within the city limits. The two remaining sites are outside of town. They're both fenced and they're both state-owned property. We're still in the planning phases to address those sites, and we hope to do that within the next 4 or 5 years. And I have to say, the Ottawa radium sites have been a part of my daily life for nearly 30 years now, and I would really like to get them finished up so I can retire. But I also think it's been it's been a great challenge. We've spent a lot of time in Ottawa. I've gotten to I've gotten to know some of the local folks. We got to know a lot of the local establishments in the 80s. I loved the banana cream pie at the Ottawa House. Really hated to see that go. We spent a lot of noon times at the Green Mill. But I would say, although it's been an extremely expensive endeavor, any of the radium risk from disposal or inappropriate disposal of materials in the city of Ottawa has been accurately remediated. And I believe I need to make sure that I acknowledge US EPA in that process. US EPA's had several different project managers that put their all into making sure this project was a success. Again, I hate to continue to mention price tags, but the remaining two sites, because of the volumes, look like they'll probably have about a $70 million price tag. When you're talking about those kind of expenses, it takes a number of years, and that's why the process has been rather slow. Anyway, we believe it's been a success, and I also believe, and I wanted to mention that the term Radium City, I think used to be viewed as a stigma, and I think the citizens of Ottawa can be very proud of their city government that it is now being acknowledged as a significant part of their history, and that the contribution to worker safety that came about as a result of the suffering from the Radium Girls is being appreciated. Thank you.
Then the Secretary of Treasury of the state of Illinois, Tim Dre, spoke about what the Radium Girls dedication meant to him.
And I'm here as a retired government lawyer who spent the bulk of his career enforcing workers' rights, wages, OSHA, and union democracy. All three of those things come together here in this town. As a labor lawyer, I know that today the issues we face in the workplace are as difficult and as obdurate as they were 70 years ago. The arguments from the employer's side are still the same, and the pain and suffering on workers is still the same. The resistance is still the same. Now, I mentioned earlier...
Then Nancy Long had a chance to talk to some of the people in the audience and Madam Pillar.
So, Geraldine, how did you get involved with this project?
The City of Ottawa, along with the Labor's Local 393 and some young girls from Mendota, Madeline Pillar and her father's a sculptor, did a play on this, and she was raising money. So we do a lot of volunteering, and this was true to our heart, plus it's right here in our Illinois Valley area. Mm-hmm. So we jumped on the bandwagon with them and raised a lot of money for this wonderful event.
So it really is a labor issue.
I think it's a labor issue. I think that's why we got involved in it. I believe that, back in the day, it was a black eye that these poor women didn't have anything to stand on as far as the OSHA Act or anything like that. And that's kind of what won them towards the end there with Mr. Grossman, their attorney. He revised a lot of different things that the other attorneys didn't do, and this was passed, and this is how they moved forward.
So now there are some protections, at least, for workers in factories.
There's a lot of more protection here in OSHA. That's one of the most wonderful things that we could ask for. It still goes on, unfortunately, today, but the unions get in there, and we try to help as many people as we can as far as any unsafe issues that go on. I know our jobs are very safe. We're trained in this now as far as our apprentices going to school and learning about safety, and we even have safety supervisor classes that we could take, and we do a lot of leadership classes at our hall. Great. So we try to educate as many people as we can out of our union hall, and that's what makes us, I think, above all the rest.
Can you tell me your name?
I'm Madeline Pillar.
This is your idea?
Yes, it was. It's my somebody had to start it, and I thought it'd be me, and away we went.
Okay. And you got support from around Illinois for this?
Yes, I did. I got support from the Chicago chapter of Women's Now. Hi, Dolores. I got from a ton of labor unions and some friends, relatives. Everyone just came together in a collaboration.
Okay. I heard what you said to young people to go with their thoughts, go with their dreams.
It's hard work, but it's... Everything that's hard is going to pay off. Doing this, something like this, is you make something beautiful out of something that wasn't.
Yeah. I'm here in honor of my aunt, and she was one of the Radium Girls who got the radium poisoning and suffered all the ill effects.
And what kind of effects did she have?
Well, as I remember as a child, she was on crutches, but later her bones would break when she'd roll over in bed. Teeth fell out, things of that sort.
Right. How long did she live after she worked in the factory?
Well, she was probably in her 20s, which would have been in, late 1920s. She died in 1953.
So she had about 30 years of after effects from working in the factory for a little while.
Yes. And that wasn't the end of it. She had one son, and he died at age 28, and that son had a son that died at age 2.
Beverly, you worked at a later factory here where the Radium Girls worked?
Yes.
Okay, when did you work in the factory?
It was in the 50s.
Okay, and what did you do there?
I painted the hands for the clocks.
But by the time you were painting, they had a different type of paint?
No, I think it was the same type, but we didn't put the brushes in our mouth.
Oh, okay. So have you had any medical problems related to
that? No, because I went to Aragon Laboratories several times. They checked me over, and I went through all their stuff, and they found nothing, nothing wrong. And then a few years after that, they sent me papers to fill out, I think about 3 or 4 years, and everything I sent back, then I didn't hear no more from them.
If you had problems, there was protection because of the women's lawsuit?
Probably. Uh-huh. Probably.
And what years were you at the...
I think from 51 or 52.
Okay.
I left because I got pregnant with my youngest daughter, so I left.
So you're celebrating all the women who worked with you and didn't make it?
Most of the women that I knew are gone.
They fought for your right to have a safe workplace. And your name is?
Shereen Kemp, and from Sheboygan. Yes, Sheboygan, Wisconsin, out of Local 1472. I came because it's about the women issues, I think, and we are from the Women's Council. And I think that was important to show the support for the UAW in this area, because we meet here, we have an education center, and I think that we need to be, let us be known here.
Well, it's a thank you to the women who went before you, too, isn't
definitely,
it?
That we're not living their lives right now.
Velma Walton.
And you are from Peoria, Illinois?
I'm from Peoria, Illinois.
Okay. And you are?
Jenny Nayling, and I'm also from Peoria, Illinois.
And you're both union members?
Yes. Yes. You're UAW 974 retirees.
Yes, both.
And what brings you here today?
For the dedication.
And is the story of the Radium Girls is kind of an important piece of union history?
Yes, it is.
Yes,
it is.
And are the people, do you think, around the Midwest aware of the importance of this case in history?
Well, I don't think they really got into it until they started asking for donations for the statue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then I think at that time, then some persons probably should have been paying more attention, but I guess maybe they didn't. But then when they asked for donations for the statue, then it became like a labor project, more or less, and labor people were getting involved, and especially our retirees from 974, and we donated money, like about 3 times toward the statue, and we also have donations that is donated from the region, from UAW, the region 4 out of Lincolnshire and out of Ottawa here. So our educational center is here.
What does the story of the Radium Girls mean to you as a union member?
Well, before I was a UAW member, I was International Ladies Garment Workers Union. So I belonged to a ladies union before this come about.
Well, and actually I did not belong to a labor union until I went to work at Caterpillar. I had worked prior to that, but in being a labor person and working at the Caterpillar facility, I became involved in women's issues, and I am chairperson of the area women's committee, and also I used to be chairperson of the locals women's committee. And this dedication being done on Labor Day weekend is really something that we should be very proud of. And as union women and union people, we are proud of that.
What
does it for today's show. I'd like to thank Nancy Long for the expose on the Radium Girls and going up to Ottawa. And I'd like to thank Art Show for letting me record the featured bands on today's show. And remember, you can tune in every Tuesday at 6 a.m. and 2 p.m. Solidarity Journal on WAZU 90.7 FM, Peoria's one and only Pacifica radio affiliate. So until next time, keep up the resistance. And that secrets have been kept.